The Federalist Papers, penned in 1787-1788 under the pseudonym Publius, represent perhaps the most influential political treatise in American history. When Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay took up their quills to defend the proposed Constitution, they couldn't have known their essays would become the definitive interpretation of American constitutional government for centuries to come. What began as persuasive newspaper articles aimed at New York voters has transformed into required reading for Supreme Court justices, constitutional scholars, and anyone seeking to understand American democracy's philosophical underpinnings. These papers weren't merely academic exercises. They were urgent political interventions at a critical moment when the young nation teetered between unity and dissolution. Having recently won independence through blood and sacrifice, Americans faced the daunting task of governing themselves without descending into the tyranny they had just escaped. The Federalist Papers offered a roadmap through this perilous terrain, articulating a vision of government powerful enough to secure liberty, yet constrained enough to prevent despotism. Their enduring popularity speaks to their timeless wisdom. Warren Buffett reportedly reads them annually, while Lin-Manuel Miranda's blockbuster musical Hamilton introduced millions to their brilliance through the show-stopping cabinet battle rap sequences. The Federalist Papers begin with a fundamental premise: America's survival depends on maintaining a strong union. Hamilton and Madison paint a vivid picture of the dangers awaiting a disunited America: foreign manipulation, interstate conflicts, and the collapse of commerce. Their arguments weren't merely theoretical, they were grounded in historical examples and contemporary realities. If we are wise enough to preserve the Union, they argue, we may for ages enjoy an advantage similar to that of an insulated situation. Geography had blessed America with natural defenses, vast oceans separating it from European powers, but only if the states remained united. A divided America would invite the same entanglements, rivalries, and wars that plagued Europe. Britain and Spain already controlled territories bordering the young nation, and both powers would eagerly exploit divisions between American states. The authors draw extensively on historical examples to demonstrate the inevitable fate of disunited states. Ancient Greek republics, despite their shared culture and interests, fell into destructive wars against each other, ultimately becoming prey to Macedonian and then Roman conquest. The German states, despite their confederation, suffered from constant internal strife that invited foreign intervention. These historical lessons served as warnings of America's potential future without a stronger union. Commercial interests provided another compelling argument for unity. A united America could negotiate favorable trade terms with foreign powers, develop a navy to protect commerce, and prevent interstate trade barriers. Hamilton, with his financial expertise, recognized that America's economic prosperity depended on creating a large, integrated market where goods could flow freely between states. He foresaw how interstate competition would otherwise lead to contradictory regulations, retaliatory tariffs, and commercial warfare that would strangle American prosperity in its cradle. The authors didn't just appeal to fear, they offered a positive vision of what a united America could become: a continental power capable of standing equal with European nations, developing its vast resources, and securing liberty for generations. This wasn't mere rhetoric, but a prescient vision of America's future global position. Having established the necessity of union, the authors turned to diagnosing why the existing Articles of Confederation had failed to secure it. Their analysis was unflinching. The Articles created a government that was a mere treaty of amity and alliance rather than a true national authority. The fundamental flaw lay in its structure. It operated on states as collective bodies rather than directly on individual citizens. This structural defect produced catastrophic consequences. Congress could make requisitions for money and troops, but lacked authority to enforce them. states routinely ignored these requests, leaving the national government unable to pay its debts, maintain troops, or fulfill treaty obligations. By 1787, the situation had become dire. Foreign creditors went unpaid, British troops still occupied American territory, and Spain blocked American access to the Mississippi River. The government was, in Hamilton's memorable phrase, reduced to a state of national humiliation. The article's defenders argued that these problems could be solved by adding specific powers while maintaining the Confederation structure. The Federalist authors systematically dismantled this position, demonstrating that the fundamental defect was structural, not merely a matter of insufficient powers. Any government that depended on states as intermediaries would inevitably face noncompliance. When states ignored federal requisitions, the only recourse would be military coercion, effectively civil war. This analysis draws on both theoretical reasoning and practical experience. Madison, drawing on his extensive study of confederations throughout history, shows how they invariably suffered the same fate, internal dissolution or external conquest. The Amphictyonic Council of Ancient Greece, the United Netherlands, and the Germanic Confederation all demonstrated the same pattern of weakness, discord, and eventual failure. The solution, they argued, must be structural, creating a government that acts directly on individuals rather than through states. This would allow laws to be enforced through ordinary courts and magistrates rather than requiring military action against recalcitrant states. This insight, that effective government requires direct operation on citizens, represents one of the Constitution's most revolutionary aspects and remains fundamental to American federalism today. Perhaps the most intellectually innovative argument in the Federalist Papers comes in Madison's famous Federalist No. 10, where he presents his theory of the extended republic. This brilliant essay turned conventional political wisdom on its head, arguing that a large republic could better protect liberty than a small one. Traditional political theory, drawing on Montesquieu and classical examples, held that republics must remain small to survive. Large territories, it was believed, inevitably required monarchical or despotic government. Madison acknowledged the problem that had led to this conclusion, the danger of faction, or groups of citizens united by interests contrary to the rights of others or the common good. In small republics, a majority faction could easily form and oppress minorities. Madison's genius was recognizing that expanding the republic's size could actually mitigate this danger. In a large republic, the sheer diversity of interests would make it difficult for any single faction to constitute a majority. "Extend the sphere," he wrote, "and you take in a greater variety of parties and interests. You make it less probable that a majority of the whole will have a common motive to invade the rights of other citizens." This theory directly addressed fears that the proposed constitution would lead to tyranny. Critics worried that a distant national government would be unresponsive to local concerns and eventually oppress citizens. Madison countered that the diversity of America would actually prevent oppression by making it difficult for any single interest to dominate. Furthermore, the selection process for representatives would refine and enlarge the public views by filtering out unworthy candidates and elevating those with true merit. The extended republic theory wasn't merely abstract philosophy. It had profound implications for America's future. It justified continental expansion and provided a theoretical framework for incorporating diverse populations into a single political system. It suggested that America's heterogeneity, far from being a weakness, could become its greatest strength in preserving liberty. This theory remains remarkably relevant today. In our era of deep political polarization, Madison's insights about the challenges of majority formation and the importance of cross-cutting interests offer valuable perspective on both the strengths and weaknesses of our political system. The Constitution's architects faced a fundamental dilemma: how to create a government strong enough to fulfill its purposes, yet constrained enough to prevent tyranny. Their solution, elaborated throughout the Federalist Papers, was a sophisticated system of separated powers that nevertheless collaborated in governing. Drawing on Montesquieu's political theory and their own practical experience, the authors emphasized the importance of dividing government into distinct departments, legislative, executive, and judicial. But they recognized that mere parchment barriers between departments would prove ineffective against power's natural tendency to encroach. Madison articulated this challenge memorably. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. This insight led to the Constitution's intricate system of checks and balances. The president could veto legislation, but faced impeachment by Congress. The Senate confirmed executive appointments and treaties, but couldn't initiate revenue bills. The judiciary interpreted laws, but depended on the other branches for enforcement and appointments. This wasn't a rigid separation, but a carefully calibrated system where each branch possessed means to defend itself against encroachment. The authors devoted particular attention to the legislative branch, which they considered the most dangerous due to its popular mandate and broad powers. To prevent legislative tyranny, they divided Congress into two chambers with different constituencies and terms. The House of Representatives, elected directly by the people for short terms, would remain responsive to popular will. The Senate, chosen by state legislatures for longer terms, would provide stability and wisdom. This bicameral structure served multiple purposes. It created an additional check against hasty or unjust legislation by requiring two bodies' approval. It accommodated both large and small states through different representation principles. And it balanced the need for popular responsiveness against the danger of democratic passions. The executive department received equally careful attention. The authors defended a single, energetic executive against proposals for plural executives or executive councils. Unity, they argued, was essential for decision, activity, secrecy, and dispatch in administration. The president's four-year term balanced independence against accountability, while re-eligibility provided incentives for good behavior. The executive department received equally careful attention. The authors defended a single, energetic executive against proposals for plural executives or executive councils. Unity, they argued, was essential for decision, activity, secrecy, and dispatch in administration. The president's four-year term balanced independence against accountability, while re-eligibility provided incentives for good behavior. The judiciary, though treated more briefly, was recognized as essential for constitutional government. Lifetime appointment during good behavior would secure judicial independence, allowing judges to interpret laws impartially and protect constitutional rights against legislative encroachment. Perhaps the Constitution's most innovative feature was its federal structure, dividing sovereignty between national and state governments. The Federalist Papers offer the most sophisticated defense of this arrangement ever written, explaining both its theoretical foundations and practical operations. This radical departure from traditional political theory challenged centuries of established thought about the nature of sovereignty. The authors rejected the prevailing view that sovereignty was indivisible, arguing instead that powers could be distributed between different levels of government. This directly contradicted influential theorists like Jean Bodin and Thomas Hobbes, who insisted sovereignty must reside in a single authority. The national government would exercise enumerated powers essential for union defense, foreign relations, interstate commerce, and currency, while states retained authority over local matters like education, criminal law, and property rights. This wasn't a mere league of sovereign states nor a consolidated national government, but a novel hybrid they called partly federal, partly national. This federal structure served multiple purposes, each carefully designed to balance power and efficiency. It preserved state governments as constituent parts of the national sovereignty through equal Senate representation while leaving them important sovereign powers. The states maintained their own militias, court systems, and taxation authority. It created multiple centers of power that could check each other, with state governments serving as sentinels against federal overreach. For instance, states could refuse to cooperate with federal officials or challenge federal laws in court. And it allowed government to operate at the appropriate scale for different problems, national for truly national concerns like war and trade, local for matters requiring intimate knowledge of regional conditions and preferences. The authors addressed widespread fears that the national government would gradually absorb state powers, arguing that state governments possessed decisive advantages, more numerous officials, closer connection to citizens, and control over citizens' everyday concerns. The powers delegated to the federal government are few and defined, Madison wrote, while those which remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. They pointed to specific structural protections, states' role in selecting federal officials, their ability to tax and regulate independently, and citizens' stronger attachment to their state governments. This federal structure wasn't merely a political compromise, but a sophisticated solution to governing a large, diverse republic. It allowed for unity on essential matters while permitting diversity and local control on others. States could experiment with different policies, becoming laboratories of democracy, as Justice Brandeis later described them. It created multiple channels for citizen participation through both state and federal elections, and multiple safeguards against tyranny through divided sovereignty. The author's defense of federalism remains remarkably relevant today as debates continue about the proper balance between national and state authority. Their insights about the advantages of both centralization and decentralization and the importance of matching governmental scale to different problems offer enduring wisdom for navigating these complex questions. Modern challenges like environmental regulation, education policy, and public health emergencies continue to test the boundaries of state and federal authority, making the Federalists' analysis of divided sovereignty as pertinent as ever. Throughout the Federalist Papers runs a fundamental commitment to republican government, rule by the people through elected representatives. The authors defend this principle against both democratic and aristocratic alternatives, articulating a sophisticated theory of representation that remains influential today. They distinguished carefully between democracy, direct rule by the people themselves, and republicanism, rule through representatives. While acknowledging democracy's appeal, they argued that representative government offered crucial advantages. It could extend over larger territories, refine public opinions through deliberation, and protect against the passions that often overwhelmed direct democracies. The Constitution established different forms of representation for different institutions. House members, elected directly by the people every 2 years, would remain closely connected to popular sentiments. Senators, chosen by state legislatures for 6-year terms, would provide greater stability and expertise. The president, selected through an electoral college, would combine independence with ultimate accountability to the people. This varied representation wasn't meant to distance government from the people, but to improve its quality while maintaining its republican character. The authors rejected the idea that representatives should be mere conduits for constituent opinions, arguing instead that they should exercise independent judgment while remaining accountable through regular elections. The Constitution's republican character is evident in its numerous democratic features: regular elections, prohibition of titles of nobility, guarantee of republican government in every state, and ultimate dependence on the consent of the people. Even the amendment process, requiring ratification by 3/4 of the states, ensured that constitutional changes would reflect broad popular consent. Yet the authors were not naive about republican government's challenges. They recognized the danger of demagogues who might flatter the people while undermining their liberties. They worried about faction and majority tyranny. And they understood that maintaining a republic required civic virtue among both citizens and representatives. Their solution wasn't to abandon republicanism, but to structure it carefully, creating institutions that would channel ambition toward public good, establishing checks against both popular passions and elite domination, and designing electoral systems that would elevate worthy representatives. The Constitution's elaborate machinery aimed not to thwart popular will, but to refine and implement it effectively. Creating an effective executive proved one of the convention's most difficult challenges. The Federalist Papers devote considerable attention to explaining and defending the presidency's design, addressing fears that this office might evolve into monarchy. The authors argued that energy in the executive was essential for good government, providing leadership during emergencies, ensuring faithful law execution, and conducting foreign affairs. Yet this energy must be reconciled with Republican principles and safeguarded against abuse. Their solution combines significant powers with meaningful constraints. Unity formed the presidency's first essential attribute. Against proposals for plural executives or executive councils, they argued that a single person would provide the decision, activity, secrecy, and dispatch necessary for administration. History showed that plural executives typically produced either deadlock or domination by the strongest personality, while diffusing responsibility that should remain clear. Duration in office constituted another crucial element. The four-year term balanced independence against accountability, long enough for the president to establish policies and demonstrate their effects, yet short enough to maintain dependence on the people. Re-electability provided incentives for good behavior while allowing the nation to retain proven leadership. The Constitution granted the president significant powers, command of military forces, treaty negotiation with Senate consent, appointment of officials, and a qualified veto over legislation. These powers enabled effective governance while remaining subject to various checks, Senate confirmation, congressional funding control, and ultimately impeachment for serious misconduct. The authors devoted particular attention to the appointment power, recognizing its importance for administrative effectiveness. They defended the system of presidential nomination with Senate confirmation as combining the advantages of single responsibility in selection with protection against favoritism or corruption. Perhaps most innovative was the method of presidential selection through an electoral college. This system aimed to ensure the president would be chosen by persons capable of analyzing the qualities needed for the position, while preventing both foreign influence and domestic faction from controlling the selection. Throughout their discussion of executive power, the authors emphasized the vast difference between an elected, term-limited president and a hereditary monarch. While critics warned of potential tyranny, Hamilton and Madison demonstrated how the Constitution's careful constraints, combined with America's Republican spirit, would prevent presidential overreach while enabling effective leadership. The judiciary received less extensive treatment than other departments in the Federalist Papers, yet the authors articulated a profound vision of its role in constitutional government. They defended judicial independence as essential for impartial justice and constitutional preservation. The Constitution established a judiciary appointed by the president with Senate consent, serving during good behavior, effectively life tenure, with salaries that could not be diminished during their service. These provisions aimed to secure judicial independence from both executive influence and legislative pressure, enabling judges to interpret laws impartially and protect constitutional rights. Hamilton's Federalist No. 78 articulated what would become known as judicial review, the power to declare laws unconstitutional. This wasn't presented as judicial supremacy over other branches, but as a necessary consequence of a written constitution with limited powers. When a law conflicted with the Constitution, judges must prefer the fundamental law to the temporary act of legislators. This power didn't stem from judicial superiority, but from the people's sovereignty expressed in the Constitution. The interpretation of the laws is the proper and peculiar province of the courts, Hamilton wrote. A constitution is, in fact, and must be regarded by the judges as a fundamental law. By enforcing constitutional limits, courts would protect the people's will against temporary legislative majorities. The authors addressed concerns about judicial overreach by emphasizing the judiciary's inherent weakness, possessing neither force nor will, but merely judgment, dependence on executive enforcement, and lacking control over either the sword or the purse. This weakness necessitated independence rather than making it dangerous. They defended the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction over both law and fact, explaining that this didn't abolish jury trials, but merely allowed Congress to regulate appeals according to the nature of different cases. The Constitution's silence on civil jury trials reflected the diversity of state practices rather than hostility to this institution. The federal judiciary structure, with one Supreme Court and inferior courts established by Congress, allowed flexibility in organizing the judicial system while ensuring uniform interpretation of national laws. State courts would retain concurrent jurisdiction in many cases, creating a complex but workable division of judicial authority. The Federalist Papers conclude by addressing the ratification process and the possibility of future amendments. The authors defended the convention's decision to require ratification by 9 states rather than unanimous consent, arguing that the article's defects made this departure necessary and justified. They acknowledged the Constitution's imperfections, but urged acceptance of this practical compromise rather than pursuit of an unattainable ideal. "I never expect to see a perfect work from imperfect man," Hamilton wrote. The diversity of state interests made unanimous agreement on any plan impossible, requiring mutual concessions to achieve a workable system. The amendment process offered a path to future improvements without risking the Union's dissolution. By requiring proposal by 2/3 of Congress or state conventions and ratification by 3/4 of states, this process balanced stability against adaptability. It allowed the Constitution to evolve through experience while preventing hasty or ill-considered changes. This vision of a living Constitution, capable of adaptation while maintaining fundamental principles, remains one of the Federalist Papers' most enduring contributions. The authors recognized that no political system could anticipate all future challenges, making provisions for orderly change essential. The Federalist Papers' concluding appeal emphasizes both pragmatism and principle. The authors urged Americans to judge the Constitution as a whole rather than focusing on particular objections. They appealed to patriotism and the common good, warning that rejection might lead to disunion and foreign domination. History vindicated their arguments. The Constitution was ratified, amendments addressed initial concerns, and the government they described has endured for over 2 centuries. The Federalist Papers themselves have become an essential guide to constitutional interpretation, cited in countless court decisions and political debates. Their enduring significance lies not just in explaining a particular historical document, but in articulating timeless principles of constitutional government, the balance between liberty and authority, the challenges of self-government, and the delicate machinery required to make a republic function. In our own era of political polarization and constitutional controversy, these insights remain as valuable as ever.